Did you see people depending more upon the country stores for credit and things like that?
Oh, yeah. This was part of the sheriff's providing system. My father's older sister's husband was in the was a merchant in Cedar Bluff, and this was the way this operated. Yes, the store would provide the needs of a farmer or a sharecropper. It didn't matter whether it's a sharecropper or not. A farmer would provide the needs of that farmer until harvest time. Then they sold their harvest, and they had a settlement of accounts. And he has told some pretty hard stories about how that a person would not have as good a crop as they had anticipated, and they would have to go to the bank and borrow more money in order to get him to loan him some more in order that he might have a better year the next year and pay him back. And how he had some clients that he never did collect on. Of course, this is a common tale of all merchants, particularly those who do business on the credit.
It is. When did you actually feel that the Depression was over?
Well, the Depression wasn't something that got over with just boom in a hurry like it had. It got over for different families at different times, depending upon their success. But by and large, the Depression wasn't over until, I would say, the late 30s, like 37, 38, and 39. In other words, World War II came just about the time the country was getting into a good recovery. For an example, my father bought the home that he bought in Valley Head in 1938. But he had incurred a lot of debts during the Depression. It took him a while to pay back this. He didn't feel like he could start making payments on a mortgage until that time. And that's the second year we lived in Valley Head.
So your father taught school around this area, or did he...
No, he taught school for a while, and for a few years in Cherokee County. He worked for the Department of Agriculture for a little bit, and then he got a job with the Brown Service Insurance, Barrel Insurance Company, and then he used to go around. He thought he was getting a job in Gadsden, and they told him that his debit was in DeKalb County, and he would live in Fort Payne. We lived in Fort Payne for a year, and my daddy became acquainted with some people in Valley Head, and he liked it. A rural mail carrier by the name of Harry Davenport was moving out of a house. He's building a brand new house. This is the Depression was beginning to get over. Mm-hmm. And it was over on Lowry Road, and Mr. Joe Underwood lives in that house right now. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he moved out of this house, and he told my daddy, if you want to move out of it, that'd be a good time to do it. So he rented the house Mr. Davenport moved out, which is the house where Ms. Ruby Gifford lives.
Right.
So
really, the Depression, just like you said, for different people, came at different times.
No, it came there about the same time. They got out of it as they could.
Right.
The opportunity presented.
Right.
But generally, I would say from about 1937 on, when people got out, it was pretty tough through 35 and 36, for most people. I remember I have some uncles who went to work in the mid-30s for Solomies over in Rome, and that was a big thing for the people in the Rome area and over in northern Cherokee County where they live.
Right. Your father, you said, was part of an agricultural board?
No, he was in the Depression. You don't worry about what your occupation is, what you're trained for. If you can find a job that will pay you for the week or for the day or the month, you take it. And one of the parochial programs was an agricultural program where they measured land. Well, unfortunately, not everybody knows how to do that.
Right.
He did.
So
it wasn't easy work. It was hard work. And he did a lot of work out in the field. He also did a lot of work. He had drafting in college, and he did a lot of work drawing off these farms in the county agent's office, putting in a number of acres down to the tenth and so forth. That's what they had in cotton, which they had to plow up. People today can't understand that, and surely the people in that day could not understand it.
That sounds good.
Hello, Okay, about World War II. Now, World War II started while I was a student in high school. And we had a new wrinkle put into our social studies. We had a day every week set aside for current events. And before World War II, one of the main things that we were studying in current events was the World's Fair. In 1939, the World's Fair was held in New York.
Oh.
And the newspapers and the magazines, particularly the magazines, had a lot to say about the World's Fair in New York. Well, it was impossible to go from about ahead to New York right after the Depression, but you know, we were quite interested in that as students. And then we started hearing about the dictators in Germany and in Italy. And first we heard about Mussolini. He started fighting in Africa and taking over former Italian colonies. And then Hitler moved on to Czechoslovakia. And next, Poland. And when he moved on Poland, and France and Great Britain declared war. Well, I was a teenager, and I thought, well, this thing will be over in 3 or 4 months, not more than a couple of years. But that wasn't the way it happened. And by 1943, the United States was in World War II very much. And I got my draft notice on the first week in January of 1943, and I had to go to before the draft board and apply for a permit. I was in my last semester of my senior year. That time you could get it. Everybody always would tell you where they were when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. Well, I'll tell you where I was. It was, of course, a Sunday afternoon. I was in the living room of my house, sitting on the sofa, and listening to the radio. And what we were listening to was the Texaco, I believe, what program that presented the classical music from Radio City in New York. So, network broadcast, sitting there listening to it, and they interrupted the program, and it was rather late, about like 5 in the afternoon, perhaps, when this happened. And, of course, everybody stayed glued to the radio until late bedtime, and then the first thing we did the next morning was turn the radio off. So, I remember that, and that was all that everybody wanted to talk about at school the next morning. And everybody had grand ideas of how we was going to defeat the Japanese in 2 or 3 months. That didn't happen. That didn't happen, of course. I was inducted in the Army at Fort McClellan, was processed in Fort McPherson, Georgia, went by rail to El Paso, Texas, and did my basic training at Fort Bliss in an anti-aircraft battalion, where I was in a 40-millimeter outfit, and about the time I was about to complete my training there, the basic training, and we had been given a battery test, and I qualified to go to a service school for a specialty. And my commanding officer called me in. He was from Birmingham. He's Captain Joseph. His father and two other fellows ran a department store down there called Loveman, Joseph, and Loeb. His father was Joseph. Anyway, he suggested that I might like to go to Fort Benning, Georgia, to Officers Carrington School. Or I could go to a radio school in Chicago. He asked me which I wanted to do, and well, I beat to him, I wanted to go to radio school. He thought I was making the wrong choice, so he told me all the advantages of being an officer and how that although the Fort Benning was tough and hard, that I would probably be better off going there. But I stuck to going to radio school, so I went to Point Radio School in the winter of 1944 in Chicago, Illinois, Coin Radio School. So I was going to be a
radio operator. That's what I wanted to do. And, you know, I thought I had achieved what I was had dreamed to do in the service. In fact, I even thought that I might like to be in the radio business in civilian life. And so I came back to Fort Bliss, and I couldn't find my outfit. I had learned that they had been shipped to Europe while I was in radio school. So I was assigned to a 90-millimeter anti-aircraft battalion, and was sent to a fire control school on that. And I kept wondering when I was going to get to be ready in radio school. One day, they sent me down on the main base by a Jeep driver. I got down there and reported to the unit I was supposed to go to, and it was enclosed a fence with a barbed wire over the top with an MP guard at the gate. I had to have a special blue pass to get in. And I discovered that I was working with a word I'd never had heard of before, radar. So I never did become a radio operator in the service. I was in the radar. And, I finished my training with that unit. It was shipped overseas, except that the captain had taken a liking to me, and he paid me cadre for the next training unit because I objected to that. And he said, "Ringer, you're going when I go." But toward the end of the war, there wasn't any Japanese or German planes to shoot down, and so I was transferred Camp Maxa, Texas, for advanced infantry training. I went through the complete advanced infantry training course, and they shipped everybody by air to fight in the Battle of the Bulge in Belgium. Only me and three other people didn't go. And got to inquiring why. They said, "Well, you're going to Camp Shelby, Mississippi." So I went Camp Shelby, Mississippi, and discovered that I had supposed to have been there the whole time I was in Camp Maxa. And because of my training in the anti-aircraft fire control, my transfer would not go through to the infantry. They had invested $40,000, which was big money in World War II, in training me, and so they were not going to waste it, so they said. So they put me in a combat engineer battalion, and I didn't use any of that training in the combat engineer battalion. I had to learn what combat engineers did. Since I was a sergeant, I had to be able to supervise that kind of work. And this is what I did, and I shipped out from Portland, Oregon, and went over to Hawaii, took jungle fighting training there for a few weeks. My unit went down to New Guinea. I was left as a rear detail loading supplies onto a convoy of landing craft, LST. And it took me 23 days to get across. And by the time I got across, made a stop at Okinawa, rendezvoused with the 2nd Marine Division at Chichijima, which is an island near Iwo Jima. They had dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, and so we were stopped and told us to stay there until further notice, and then they dropped the bomb on Nagasaki, and a few days later they signed the peace treaty. So I went to Sasebo, and then from Sasebo down to Nagasaki. So that is the about the extent of my overseas. I went ashore there, and they said we had taken the island, but as far as I could tell, we had, from where the water's edge was up to the, on the beach up to the foot of the cliff, the Japanese had the rest of it. Well, I certainly remember the battle wagons firing those big shells overhead at night. Rather nerve-wracking.
I bet. In the battle, you said you went to Japan and saw several of the things, which was... you mentioned that you had seen, what was it, Hiroshima, or the other one where they dropped the atomic bomb?
Well, actually, I was at Nagasaki from in September until around mid-November. Then I was stationed at Fukuoka. But my journey up to Nagoya to
come home, I went through, went by rail, I went through Hiroshima, so I got to see. As I said, though, as far as a town being, a city being utterly destroyed, I went through Kobe. Kobe would compare to the United States to Pittsburgh. It was where they, where their heavy industry was, steel making, this sort of thing. And it wasn't anything but rubble there.